Good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and we invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding, and he and his wife Julie and their two kids live in East Texas. Cliff, welcome back for another show.
Hey, Bill, I'm glad to be here, and it's a cozy little studio today. Cool outside and cozy in here.
Nice and warm in here. We like it when the power works around here.
Yeah.
So, once again, if you have a question tonight about birds or birding, you can give Cliff a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Also, if you have photos that you would like Cliff to identify, you can send them to us at my address, wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. And we'll get to those during the next show. We won't have time tonight. Cliff, at the end of last month's program, we had a conservation tip, and could you remind our listeners what that was all about?
Yeah, last month we had our game wardens as our guests, and I thought it'd be appropriate to give more of a personal tip that is conservation related, and that's protecting your ears, because those ears aren't going to grow back like a lizard's tail that breaks off, right? And that those ears are important for the person to enjoy nature and remain a conservationist. So in a way, it has something very much to do with conservation. And so what I recommended is, no matter how old you are, and you've got to protect your ears. Even if you're starting late in life, it's better to start now than never. With life, having a lifetime of loud noises at work and home, it could be a problem. So you won't be able to hear birds if you lose your ears. And we mentioned some other things. We got a lot of chuckles when we said that you wouldn't be able to not only hear birds, but maybe not your grandkids, the television, and your pets, and also your spouse. So he got a lot of people giggling and chuckling about that you wouldn't be able to hear your spouse if you lose your ears. But I know a lot of people that don't want to hear honey-do lists of...
Yeah, but you could lose your life that way.
That's,
you know, you got to take care.
Good point. So we want people to protect their ears so they remain conservationists, so they remain in the outdoors doing things like birding, hiking, hunting, fishing, etc. So protect your ears and do it for the birds.
All right. And as always, we open our each show with a profile of a bird. And what do you have for us this month?
Well, we're going to talk about the purple martin. And you might be wondering why we decided to profile the migratory purple martin during the cold month of December, when this species is currently wintering in the tropics. But more on that in a minute. First, though, let's listen to the liquid gurgles and loud chortling of a few purple martins. Lots of gurgles, lots of chortling, just a very pleasant song, calls of the purple martin. So this species is our nation's largest species of swallow and is a very popular insectivorous bird that feasts on aerial insects like wasps, moths, grasshoppers, dragonflies, katydids, and more. They overwinter throughout South America, east of the Andes, and as far south as northern Argentina and southeastern Brazil. The male is overall dark and can look purpley blue when the lighting is just right. Otherwise, they have that dull, blackish silhouette look. Females and young of the year are duller, with some gray and white in their chest and belly. To see a photo of a purple martin in flight, which was snapped by James Childress of Lufkin, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org. Okay, back to why we chose the profile the purple martin during a winter month is that early arrivals return to the Red River Radio listening area in January and February. So we wanted to give you a bit of a heads up. These early birds are searching for martin boxes placed in the best spots, or they're merely taking a break on a journey farther north. Some folks call these early birds, quote, scouts. But this implies that they return south to the masses to report their findings on the breeding grounds. This simply is not true. The so-called scouts are merely early arrivals, and they're typically older males staking claim to their martin box. Think of it like one of us arriving early to a ball game or movie theater with general admission seating where you're trying to save an entire row for family and friends. This arriving early, however, can be deadly, as late winter storms that linger for days might not be conducive for insect activity. This means no food in the pantry for such early arriving martins. This species likes to nest in a communal setting, and martin landlords have to battle other cavity users that are sometimes overly aggressive, like house sparrows and European starlings. If you plan to mount a martin box on your property because your next door neighbors have martins and you really like those birds, remember that you're sharing the same airspace. That means you probably won't start an additional colony, but instead could start a neighborhood feud if you lure the neighbor's colony to your new box. Also, keep in mind that just because you spent a lot of time and a lot of money placing a martin box up on your property does not mean that you'll get guaranteed occupancy. Some martin boxes are placed in unfavorable sites, like under a tree canopy. So be sure your property is right before making the effort. Some Native Americans and early settlers placed hollowed out gourds for these birds near their homes, and in turn got birds that ate pesky insects. They served as alarm clocks like a rooster, and these martins were similar to a ready guard dog that vocalized a distress call when something unfamiliar appeared on the horizon, like a predator or unfamiliar persons, maybe your enemy approaching. So this concludes a little background information on the purple martin.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Anything regarding birds and the avian world is welcome. And we have our first caller online, Leon from Bossier City. Leon, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
The question is, I've heard that buzzards do not have an anus.
Ah.
And I wondered if that's true.
Yeah, that's an old wives' tale that is not true. And I think the reason that one started as an old wives' tale is when you approach a vulture, especially when they're nesting in an old barn or an old building, their first line of defense is to throw up. And that means they're throwing up stuff that they ate that was probably dead on the road for a while, and think how nasty that would be. So that's not how they get rid of waste. And I think that's what started that whole wives' tale is, oh, look, he's getting rid of it by throwing it up. Must not have an anus. No, that's not what he's doing. He's not trying to get rid of waste. He's trying to get rid of you. All birds have a complete digestive tract that includes the start and the finish.
Thank you okay. so much. I'll advise my learned friends.
Yes.
That.
All right, Leon. Thank you.
Well, you learn something new every day here on Bird Calls, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502.
And I settled a bet once. At Parks and Wildlife, we receive these kinds of calls, and a fellow from a hunt club called and said he was sitting around the campfire the weekend before, and they had an argument over that exact topic. And so he was calling to settle the bet, and so I helped him win a few dollars, I think.
Well, hopefully he bought you a beer out of that.
Yeah.
So, well, give us a call, folks. All lines are open right now, so any question regarding our avian world is welcome. 800-552-8502. And in the meantime, we did have a couple of folks write in, and one of those was Chelsea, and she wrote in, if I can find it in my script, from Nacogdoches County, and she had recorded the sound of a bird on her property last March, and she wanted to confirm that she thought it was a particular bird, and she just wanted to confirm. So yeah, let's give a listen to that here real quick. You can barely hear it in the background. Okay, so she thought it was a chickadee, and she wasn't sure.
Yeah, and we liked her assessment, and we thought we'd play our recording that's a little louder. So let's listen to the chickadee.
You hear that dee, 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 dee.
Yep. And in our listening area here in the South, we only have one kind of chickadee. This is the Carolina chickadee. If you grew up in the North, the Great Lakes, for example, or the Northeast U.S., you had the black-capped chickadee. But you're in the South, friend, and we have the Carolina chickadee.
There you go.
And so Chelsea nailed it. She also did a great job of recording it, I presume, with her cell phone, because that's what we tell mm-hmm. listeners to do. If they have a bird that they can record, is use your cell phone, set it on video. Don't worry about what it's showing in the video. Just worry about what that microphone is capturing, and then send that to us like Chelsea did. So great work. So the chickadee has that really, really clear whistle. Sounds like someone whistling. So we wanted to play, and I think we did it last month or the month before, but it doesn't hurt to do it again. We want to play another bird in our listening area with a very clear whistle. Let's listen. And this is the white-throated sparrow. So they're singing all over the place. We've got them in our backyard, and it doesn't matter if it's a 29-degree morning or a 67-degree afternoon. They're whistling that very clear whistle that sounds like they're saying, "Oh, Sam Peabody, Peabody, Peabody," and that's the white-throated sparrow. So we wanted to just play the two different species that have very clear, distinctive whistles that you might think are your neighbor whistling, but they're indeed birds. So the first one, thanks to Chelsea, is the Carolina chickadee. And then I wanted also followed up with the white-throated sparrow. Okay?
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have all lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world is welcome, and we hope you'll call in. And we had another listener from Millette Reed from Heath, Texas, which is over in Rockwall County. And she posed a couple of questions and wanted to know, first of all, what birding guides does Cliff recommend for the North Central Texas area?
Well, if you're birding in the North Central Texas area, so the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, and then north of that and a little bit east, a little bit west, there is a book that came out in the 80s called The Birds of North Central Texas by Warren Pulich. And that book doesn't have it's not a book you want for pictures. It's a book you want for very good details like arrival dates, how abundant are they, where do they occur, things like that. So you have to have Birds of North Central Texas, even though I think it was 1987, it's still pretty valid. So that's a must-have. You can find that. It's out of print. It's Texas A&M University Press. You can still find it on the used book market, and it's a must-have. If you need a field guide with pictures, there are so many now. There's not going to be one just for North Central Texas, and really, there's my favorites are the ones that you can use anywhere you travel in the U.S., the continental U.S., things like the National Geographic Society's guide that's been around since I was a kid. First edition, I think, came out in 81 or 83. I was still in high school when that came out. I love that book. I think it's on its 8th or 9th or 10th edition by now. The Sibley Guide's very good. You know, you can't beat Roger Troy Peterson's book because he was one of the first. And The Golden Guide is a must. That's a 60s, initially in the 60s, publication by Golden Press. And that's a Chandler Robbins as author. And that's a great book. So I like having multiple field guides because sometimes the artist doesn't capture that bird perfectly. One that comes to mind is the female bay-breasted warbler. I don't know many field guides that really capture that one perfectly, and they look kind of different depending on the book you're looking at. But multiple guides really help, and I prefer ones with paintings over photos. I love photos, but think about the photo of you in the yearbook where your eyes are closed and you're like, oh man, that's not how I look. And that's sometimes the problem with photographs, is it captures the pose that's not really representative of that species, but the artist can really capture that because the artist is doing what I like to call an average of lots of photographs, lots of museum specimens, and trying to melt that down into one image. But there are some very fine field guides with photos. Ken Kaufman's book that's not been around but maybe 15 years or so, maybe it's been 20, but that one's got some digitally enhanced photos that are really good. So kind of a long answer on that question.
And as a photographer, I can tell you birds don't like to pose.
That's
don't
true.
Like to cop a pose.
Yes,
you know? So
that's
you can
true.
Get a nice image. It's
yes,
very tough sometimes.
Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go now to Ted from Longwood. Ted, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Good evening. Thank you for the opportunity. Hey. About the Purple Martin.
Okay.
We talked briefly about housing. We were listening to that.
Okay.
So describe the construction. You know, you have different kinds. Some are metal, some are wood, some are plastic. How many houses, if you have a pole with several on it, positioned close to what, positioned away from what, and other things that might attract these birds, like your neighbors. I have some neighbors that are successful mm-hmm. with theirs, but I've never been successful with mine.
Right. That's a good long list of questions, Ted. And I will say that a friend of mine named Jim Ray wrote a booklet for Texas Parks and Wildlife that is available on the Texas Parks and Wildlife website. You can just Google that agency name and Purple Martin booklet, and it is worth reading. It's a short read, but it would answer all those questions that we just don't have time to get into. We could probably have a whole hour and a half just on Purple Martin details and information like the questions you asked. But I would encourage you, Ted, and others listening to go to that page, that website, and look up that booklet and read it. And it's very informative, and Jim Ray of Amarillo area did a very good job putting together a booklet about Purple Martins. And it's free. It's on the internet. I'm not telling you to go buy something. I'm sharing a really worthy site that goes through a lot of the stuff, if not everything you just asked, Ted.
Could we spell the last name of Ray?
R-A-Y.
As simple as it is.
Yes, and his first name is J-I-M, so three and three letters on each. Jim Ray, or James Ray, and it's, again, Texas Parks and Wildlife Purple Martin booklet. Martin is spelled with a M-A-R-T-I-N.
I got it.
And you'll get the booklet. It'll come out. You can even print it as a PDF, I believe, and it's a great read. He did a fantastic job on that booklet, and it's available for free to the public. So, yep.
Thank you so much, and I enjoy your show.
Oh, great.
And the conversations with wildlife people a week or two ago.
Yes, great. Thank you, Ted.
Good night.
All right. Thank you, Ted. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open now. We're going to go next to Clay from Lufkin. Clay, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Yeah, I was going to ask about We have a bird that we always call the whippoorwill when we go down the Neches River to our cabin down there. And lately I've seen that the chuckwheel willow is also in this area. And I just wonder if is it the whippoorwill or is it the chuckwheel willow that we see?
Yeah, good question. And this is one that we like to bring up often because it is very confusing. And in the listening area, including Lufkin area, we do have both species, but the whippoorwill is only a migrant, so it's got a very limited time that it's flying and calling in our area. It's the chuckwheel's widow that is here all spring and summer long, and so if you hear one in June, it's going to be a chuckwheel's widow. July, same thing. And let's listen. Here's chuckwheel's widow. And if it's real far away, you won't hear the chuck. You'll just hear the Will's widow. Will's widow.
I think that's the bird that we always just call the whippoorwill. My grandfather and everybody just said it's the whippoorwill. And it's just been recently I even knew there was a chuckwheel widow.
Right.
Yeah.
It's something that's been misidentified for a century. And here's whippoorwill. Let's listen.
Right.
Much faster.
It's faster. It's incessant. Yeah. And the whippoorwills, the best time to listen in our listening area at this latitude where we are, it is the last week of March and the first week of April. That's when they start pouring through. And then chucks come right on the heels of them. You can have both overlapping. But I've heard whips a little bit sooner than I've heard chucks. And those whips are going through here, and they're going farther north. They're breeding as south as the Wachita Mountains, so they don't go very much farther north than Texarkana into the Wachitas, the Waldron area, for example.
Okay.
So that's as far south, really, as a guaranteed whippoorwill is going to be. But in our listening area, and that means Shreveport, Lufkin, Nacogdoches, Tyler, Longview, if you grew up in the summer hearing that and you called it a whippoorwill, you got to erase that from your memory bank and correct it. It's a chuckwheel's widow. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty much sure, yeah. We drive down the river and there's always the birds right in the middle of the road.
Yeah.
And we just listen for them and we'll stop and listen. And it's the chuckwheel widow, I'm pretty sure, yeah, by the sound. So.
Yeah. And so you've got a lot of literature that mentioned the whippoorwill. A lot of writers from the Northeast where you have whippoorwills would write about the beautiful song of the whippoorwill, and so everybody just figured, well, if we hear a beautiful song at night, it must be a whippoorwill. Nuh-uh. There are several species, including this chuckwheel's widow. So, yeah, it's always good to remind folks that it's the chuck, and I'm glad you talked about that, Clay. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
And they are both nocturnal callers.
That's correct. Yeah. And so I should mention when I said that listen for whips in that last little bit of March, do it right at dusk, right when the trees lose color. There might be a little bit of orange in the sky, just a little bit. And the pine trees way off don't look green anymore. They look black. And that's when the whips will start calling right at dusk and then into the evening. A little bit longer than that, of course.
And the chucks will go into the deep night, won't they?
Yes, yeah. And I've mentioned this before on the radio show. I camped at Boykin Springs years ago, decades ago, and the tent was right under one that was calling all night. And I, you know, at first I was like, hey, this is cool. After about 10 minutes, I was like, hey, I want to get to sleep.
Yeah.
His volume was really high, and, you know, It is tough. I've gotten calls at Parks and Wildlife from people that sleep in with their windows open that had a chuck singing right outside the window, and they wanted to know what they could do. And it's just one of those things, you know. I hate to say it, but it's one of those sounds that it could get annoying to you. But I tell people, hey, it's better than being in the city when you're hearing car alarms all night or the neighbor's dog barking all night or the party with the music on really loud. So take your pick, and I'd take the Chuck Wills Widow over all those others.
And the interesting thing is I recorded that Chuck Wills Widow, and he went on for over an hour and a half. I mean, he just kept going on out there. I was out in the country at the time.
He must have been a muy macho male.
I guess so, but he was keeping me entertained. Yeah. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have all lines open right now. You can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world is welcome. Again, 800-552-8502. All lines are open. We're going to go back to Millette Reed from Heath, Texas. She had a second question there, and this is an interesting question for those app designers out there. If there is not one, then this might be an interesting app to create, and that's what she asks. Are there any birding apps that can be used or recommended for smartphone users?
Oh, yeah. There's a whole bunch, and I'm not a technology guy by any means, but once I put these two on my phone, I've fallen in love with them. And one of them is just the Audubon app. It's free. You go to the App Store. It's by the National Audubon Society. It's basically a field guide as an app. It's great. You can search by species. It has range maps. It has vocalizations. I love it. And the icon, it's got a great egret with an orange circle as a background. That's what the icon looks like for the app. The other app I have that I really like is by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and it's called Merlin, M-E-R-L-I-N. And that one's really a lot of fun for beginners because it will help you figure out what that bird is. You tell it where you are, and it's going to ask you a few questions, some pretty basic questions like size and color and what was it doing. And then they'll say, well, we think it might be one of these. And all of a sudden, the choices of 350 possible species is trimmed down to maybe a dozen or less. And so it doesn't nail it to the species every time. But it gets you to a ballpark that's a lot more manageable.
Now, are these designed to listen to the calls or to take photos and identify the photo?
No, it's designed to ask you simple questions about what you see in the bird. So maybe you're looking out at your bird feeder and you see that it's smaller than the cardinal, and you would put that in there because it says general size. And what color is it basically overall, and what's it doing? And, you know, if you said, well, it's clinging to a tree, then it would say, well, maybe it's one of these woodpeckers or this nuthatch or brown creeper, depending on what else you answered. So I really like that app. It's also free. Keyword free. Both of these apps that I've mentioned are free. So Merlin is the one to help identify birds. And then the Audubon one is the one I mentioned that's basically like a field guide on your cell phone. You don't need to carry a book anymore with that app. It's got, like I mentioned, range maps, vocalizations, a little bit of natural history about the bird. It's fantastic. So I really like having both of those. I still do like my books. I'm that generation that does like paper. But I'm also that generation that does like a cell phone. I'm a betweener. And so I like a little bit of both. And I think the books are sadly getting phased out. The next generation, they're probably not even going to know what it's like to turn a page in a book. But they sure know how to whip through the apps on their cell phone. So
suddenly Bob Singer's song "Turn the Page" has no more meaning. So it would be interesting, though, to create an app that recognizes the sound of the chirp and could help you identify it. That would be a fascinating. It would be a labor intensive one.
Yeah, and I that might even exist, and I might not even know about it. But I'm not aware of anything where you can. You know, the big problem with that is you got to have super duper equipment to get the quality recording, because otherwise it's going to be so dim.
Yeah, you have so much background.
Right, because we've got that app for music called Shazam, which is really cool. My wife's got that on her phone, and you turn that on and point it basically at the speaker, like when we're driving the car, and within seconds it tells you who's singing that song, right, and what the name of the song is. And so you'd think that that technology could also work. But, you know, there is variation in bird song and bird calls, and it's based on several things. And, you know, regional dialect is a biggie. It'd be just like when you travel around as a human and you start asking for directions. And, boy, you can tell when you're in the South, because people sound different than they do. Oh, and we're up here in the Great Lakes, and yeah, we'll show you how to get to that place you're lost. So those
that's Minnesota, by the way.
That's very good. So those regional dialects in humans are reflective also in birds, and so that might have a little trouble with an app. You might have a little bit of trouble getting that app to recognize dialects, but that's the beauty of technology. It mm-hmm. should be able to recognize many different signatures, and so that I would think that's coming. But there's plenty of good stuff out there, and the Merlin app is really very helpful.
You're listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. We still have all lines open, so you can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Now, the annual Christmas bird count is coming up. And could you talk a little bit about the bird count, what folks can do?
Yeah.
We have a list and a post up on our website. You can see it. It says Christmas bird count schedule for winter 2018-19. And that's on our website. So you can actually download this list and get the email addresses of who to contact if you would like to participate in one of these bird counts. But tell us what the bird count is all about.
Yeah, so the Christmas bird count is the longest citizen science project in the U.S., if not the world. It started in the year 1900, and it started when an ornithologist at the American Museum by the name of Frank Chapman saw this tradition of shooting as many birds as you can and teams competing of whose pile was bigger and which pile had the most species and all these dead birds, and you weren't going to do anything else with them. It's not like you were going to cook them and eat them. And he quickly saw, even in 1900 or before that, he saw in the 1890s that this wasn't sustainable, probably not a good idea. So he initiated in 1900 the Christmas bird count, and it has spread like wildfire. In as of 2012, there were 60,000 people in 20 countries participating in the Christmas bird count. I should update my cheat sheet here, but that's of 2012. And we have about, in Texas, about 117 different counts. In Louisiana, about 25. The listening area includes parts of Mississippi and Arkansas, and those each have under 30 Christmas counts. But what you can do is, if you're in our listening area, we put 10 of the most popular Christmas count, or really 10 Christmas counts that are in the listening area, and they're also included is the date that it's occurring and the compiler's email, so you can volunteer and contact that compiler and say, hey, I'd like to learn how I can help. I'm in that area of this count of, you know, count X, and I'd like to contribute my time and effort. And a lot of these compilers are looking for people in the count circle to help with backyard bird feeders. You can count things that are coming to your feeder. And if you've got a hummingbird overwintering with you, which we did in our backyard mm-hmm. last winter, we had a Rufus hummingbird stay with us for about 5 months. That count compiler is going to want to hear from you. And so the count circle is a 15-mile diameter circle, and it's a 24-hour count, and it's basically counting every bird you see and hear in that circle for a 24-hour period. And you also include how much effort you spent. And the beauty is we can use those data over time to get trends. And so that's the end beauty of the Christmas bird count, is we get data that tell us whether birds are declining. Maybe they're not declining. Maybe they're stable. It also lets us know when we have what we call eruptions. These are birds that might be cyclical in their occurrence. Things like purple finch and red-breasted nuthatch. And even other things like pine siskins, depending on where you are. These birds wander around and would show hot spots in certain areas, certain winters, and be gone different winters. So the Christmas bird count data is pretty neat stuff. And so I like to do it. I go out with a couple buddies, and we spend the day looking for birds and just having a good old time. And I really encourage people to contribute their time to the Christmas bird count.
Now, the earliest count that I have is on the 14th, and that is in the Red River District, Red River Parish. So that starts on the 14th and goes all the way up through early January. So.
Yeah, the count period starts December 14th and ends January 5th. And what they try to do is during that 3 weeks is try to spread them out evenly, because there are a lot of people. If you live in our listening area, you might want to participate in several of these. So it's not good to have them all on the same day during that window of December 14th to January 5th. So the idea is to spread them out, and then your observers will be able to spread out their time and participate in multiple counts. So, yeah, we call it the Christmas bird count. It does not mean it occurs on Christmas Day. It just occurs in the Christmas season.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and all lines are open right now. You can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birding and our avian world are welcome. And we're going to go on to a couple of photos that I was fortunate enough to snap. As I told Cliff, I like to go out and photograph. Unfortunately, birds, they're not real, cooperative. However, I was out at Lake Bistineau this past month, November, and spied this beautiful, large, white bird right in the middle of a huge set of cypress. I mean, a gigantic cypress tree. It was really beautiful out there, the yellow flowers and everything. But this bird, at first I thought, well, it doesn't look like a blue heron. And, I've seen some other white birds, but I wasn't sure. So what kind was this?
Yeah, that was the great egret. And boy, I was distracted by the massive cypress that you were talking about that's in the same frame. So I encourage people to look at that picture that Bill's posted online. The bird looks tiny because that tree is so huge, but it is a great egret.
I was fortunate down here right in the center of town. There's several of them as well in one of the bayous that they don't like to pose either. So every time I tried to get closer, they'd fly off. But I caught them in flight. Huge wingspans on those.
Yes. And we've got several that are all white. This is the tallest one. It's the size of a great blue heron. It's maybe a little bit slimmer, maybe an inch shorter, but he's almost the size of a great blue heron, so it's a large bird. He's all white, and again, he's great egret. There are smaller all white herons and egrets, but this is our largest one.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. Lines are open right now, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Well, I don't have the name yet, but I'm going to go to our next caller. You're online with Cliff. What's your name, and where are you from, and what is your question tonight?
Okay, my name is Carlin, and I'm calling from Houghton. And I have a question and a comment. Question first. My son lives in Richards, Texas, on a ranch, and is there any particular regional bird guide that would cover that area? It's about an hour inland from Houston, and it's Piney Woods Prairie Habitat, and that was a question. And then the comment is that he was speaking of siskins. Well, I had several at my feeder last winter, and I did the Cornell feeder watch, and I had a pair of siskins, and I also had a pink-sided junco, which I don't know what he was doing here,
yeah.
But it was quite exciting.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, the juncos can really move around, and there's several varieties of dark-billed juncos, and so that's cool that you had that one and the pine siskin. I haven't had a pine siskin yet this winter.
This was last winter.
Good. So your son, the question about your son, I would say he ought to try to look up the Houston Audubon Society's website since he's so close to Houston. They have a lot of information that's available. They have a really good Upper Texas Coast checklist that I recommend that's really helpful.
Okay, well, he's inland.
Yeah.
But speaking of the Houston Audubon, I can't remember the name of the island.
Galveston?
High Island,
yep. And High Island's not really an island. It's on the...
I understand that.
Okay.
My question is, did it get wiped out by the hurricane?
No. No, and it's been battered by many hurricanes over the last two decades. Actually, for the last several centuries. But in recent times, especially since I've become aware of High Island, which was my first trip was 1986, and I've watched it get battered by many, many hurricanes, even ones that we don't hear about that might be a Category 1 or a tropical storm. Sometimes those tropical storms are brutal because they just sit on top and dump water, gallons and gallons of water. But Harvey was more, I mean, Harvey did get up there, but it didn't devastate High Island. I mean, they like I said, they've been hammered by so many hurricanes. They're going to lose trees, but they've got plenty left to spare. So High Island is a great migratory stopover site. It's right on the kind of the eastern edge of Galveston County. You cross the ferry onto Bolivar Peninsula and drive for about 30, 35 miles. And you get to this this oasis. It's basically an oak mod or a woodlot out in a sea of marsh and grass, and that's where it gets the name High Island. It's sitting on a salt dome, so it's not a true island. It just looks like an island. But it's the first set of trees that these migrants see and hit after they've crossed the Gulf of Mexico.
It's a fantastic place to go.
Yeah, and I have not missed a spring migration since my first visit in 86. It was such a religious experience for me that I have returned every spring for a minimum of 2 days, and the most I was there was 9 days straight back in my college days, and I just love it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, cool. All right. Well, thanks for the call.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world and birds are welcome. And we do have one more photograph that we had posted online. And as I said, do some photography. And we have a beautiful pond here right in the middle of Shreveport, just not too far from here, called the Duck Pond, obviously. Mm. Lots of ducks there. And also some egrets I've seen down there and some beautiful turtles. There's a wide variety of ducks, but I happened to capture this duck who just happened to be posing. And he was one of the rare ones. He just sat there and posed for me as he was snuggled up in the shrubbery and got this beautiful photograph. Now, you said it was a domestic duck,
yes.
But it really is a duck that's just gotten used to people, correct?
Well, and the domestic also because a lot of these ducks didn't get there on their own. They were released by duck fanciers, bred in captivity, and people that think that they beautify a pond, whether it's a city pond or a neighborhood pond. They think, oh, you know what this pond needs are some pretty ducks and geese, and so they dump ducks and geese out there, and some people like them, some don't. So you end up with probably a 50-50 ratio of what people appreciate or don't appreciate. Because, you know, if you have little kids, some of those ducks and geese that are used to being hand-fed get aggressive, and they're eye level to your toddler.
Right.
So that's a problem. But the bird that you photographed is a Muscovy duck, and it comes in a wide variety of colors, usually a white with black or black with white, but the main thing is around the face it has a lot of bare red skin that looks knobby and bumpy. We call that crunkles. If you think of a turkey, it kind of has that look to it. So the face isn't very attractive. It looks maybe like it's got a bad case of acne, but that's the Muscovy duck. And so those are not native. They're not natural. They were bred in a domesticated setting and released. They're wild. They're put out in the wild, and they're expected to fend for themselves. But they end up needing humans for their entire life, and that's sometimes bad, because would you want to live a life of 10 years of eating Wonder Bread, white bread? No. So I think that a lot of people are very upset with these ducks. They leave a lot of poop. Kids then step in it, and again, you know, some of these ducks will chase you, but they are pretty, no question. And where I live, there's a pond on the SFA campus called the Ag Pond, and there are buku ducks there that people just love. They come to visit and feed the ducks and look at all the colors, and then there are lots of different Muscovies and lots of different domesticated varieties of mallard ducks. So those are all done in a cage setting.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And can be enjoyed.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have all lines open right now at 800-552-8502. But we did have a question submitted through the phone bank there, and this was a caller from Atlanta, Texas, and she remembered growing up and seeing lots of bluebirds in our area, and she wanted to know what happened to the bluebirds. They are not in the number that she thought when she grew up.
Well, I think you could probably change. You could take out bluebird and put just about anything in there, with some exceptions, like things that are going the opposite direction upward, Eurasian collared dove, great-tailed grackle, black vulture. But for the most part, a lot of birds are declining. Now, I wouldn't say that bluebird has gone from super numerous to nothing. And in the wintertime, you can still see big flocks of eastern bluebirds. So I would challenge her to come back to Atlanta in the cold winter, even do a Christmas bird count. That's when you have a really good shot at seeing even 20 or 30 bluebirds together in one berry-giving bush or tree, and they'll be just chowing down on those berries. So, or driving along some of our backcountry roads and watching for bluebirds sitting on the fences and the wires. So bluebirds are still around, but, you know, if there's a decline, that's not going to make the top 10 by any means, not even the top 100 of declines that we are seeing in our bird life. It's kind of holding steady, if not doing fairly well, because it's so popular as a cavity-using bird by people putting out nest boxes. And by the way, we're going to talk about nest boxes at the end of the show.
All right. You're listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. In the meantime, as somebody who likes to do photography, and I know we get a lot of questions, what are the birding hot spots in our area? If you could go through some of the really wonderful places, if people really want to see wildlife and avian wildlife in particular.
Well, okay, if you're wanting to start off with photography and you're wanting
or just bird watching,
or starting off with birds, I always recommend a wetland, because it's very open and there are usually large birds around or in the wetland, and the wintertime is the best. So right now is a great time to look for a pond, a wetland. Go nearby here. The Red River National Wildlife Refuge has wetlands, and there are often buku ducks and coots and egrets and herons and ring-billed gulls flying by that are worth looking at. And they're all large birds. And for a beginner, that makes a big difference. So I would say start at a wetland and look for birds that way, because if you wanted to start in, say, a grassland, Your birds are typically little, they're nondescript, and they hide in the grasses, and that makes it a big challenge. I would never start a beginner out in a grassland with things like savanna and LeConte sparrows.
How about wooded areas during the wintertime where the leaf foliage is gone? Is that a good place to maybe do, especially like in the early mornings when they're not flying and in flight yet, to maybe, of course, it's darker there, so the lighting is not necessarily perfect.
Yeah, your activity in birds are best in the morning hours, especially when it's cold. Birds have had to stay warm through the night. That means they've burned a lot of calories. So when they get up on a cold morning, they are hungry, ready to refuel. Bottomland hardwood forest is like you described. It's leafless often. It can be full of birds. I'll tell you a trick. It is, if you find an owl calling, the real thing, go over near it, because there'll be a lot of songbirds that are mobbing that owl, and that's where you can see a dozen species of birds all together doing kind of like a neighborhood watch program, trying to oust that predator, the owl. So some bird watchers have learned to imitate or play the recording of a barred owl, for example, in the bottoms, the river bottoms, in the wintertime. And that's when you can get several species of woodpeckers, including yellow-bellied sapsucker, northern flicker, red-headed woodpecker, red-bellied woodpecker, downy woodpecker, pileated woodpecker. All these will come in, and you'll get one or two species of kinglets. You can get titmice and chickadees and towhees and thrashers and all these birds that are coming in to mob the owl. So think about, if you're in an area that's not heavily birded, you don't want to do the owl recording in a high traffic area. Because if everybody did it, it wouldn't be a good idea. So limit its use, and it's a lot of fun. But if you do hear an owl, and we hear them in our backyard, we often go to look to see who's mobbing that owl. And then you'll see blue jays and robin and mockingbird. And, I mean, the list is long of these birds that are scolding and mobbing the owl. But the woods can come alive on a winter morning when there's an owl still awake, hadn't gone to bed yet because he's, of course, been up all night. But when the songbirds find him, look out.
You're listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We still have time to get your calls in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And there'll be one more question here, and that is, when you want to do photography, how close is too close? I mean, you want to try to get a full frame photograph, which means you're probably going to have to use a telephoto lens, because you can only get so close to most of these birds before they scatter.
Right. What we recommend is stay 50 yards away. And so that's half of a football field. I think most people can relate to how far that is. You don't need to use a tape measure. You could use what's called a rangefinder, or you can just go practice and go out to a football field, look at what the 50-yard line looks like from the goal line, and use that as your barometer when you go out in the field. But we recommend 50 yards or more from the bird, because if less than that, you can, especially at rookeries, this is a big conservation issue. It's the hot summer. These birds, pelicans on the coast with spoonbills and herons and egrets, are nesting, and boaters and nature tourists might get too close and flush those birds off their eggs. Well, then all of a sudden those eggs are very vulnerable to predators. So here come the laughing gulls that are wanting to eat those eggs. Here's the hot sun that's baking those eggs, because if you eggs need to stay warm, but not cooking in the sun warm. So actually, when it's really hot out, the adults are shading the eggs from the hot sun. So if these birds keep getting kicked up and spooked by people that are getting closer than 50 yards, it's a big problem. So 50 yards away is what we like to recommend, especially when these birds are in sensitive periods like the nesting season.
All right. We just had a caller coming in. I'm trying to get that in real quick.
Okay.
While we have a chance, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we'll wait for that call to come in. And in the meantime, do you have a recommendation on the kind of lens, I guess? You know, you're going to need a telephoto lens if you're 50 yards away.
Yeah, that is not an endangered species anymore. I can tell you in the 30-plus years I've been birding, it's amazing how many bird watchers now are also carrying around a gigantic digital SLR camera with lens and doing some amazing stuff. I mean, it's the old-timers that have photographed have gotten out of it because they say that, well, now everybody's an expert because the equipment's so great. And when it was film, you didn't have, you couldn't take 500 pictures of that bird that's sitting there for an hour. You took just a few and hope to goodness when you got them back in a week that one of them was great. Well, now you can just shoot away, and certainly one of those 75 pictures you just shot of that bird is going to be really good quality, and it's a pretty impressive to see. And I'll tell you, it's been really helpful. Because those pictures are there for documentation purposes.
Okay. We got one last caller real quick. Cliff from Rectal, Texas. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Rectal? Rectal. Yeah, well,
probably.
I can't really see it there. You're on with Cliff. What's your question? Very quickly, please.
I'd like to know why the black crows around here, when they get together and they squawk and sounds like a bunch of old hags over there. You know?
Yeah.
Why do they do that?
Well, crows are very social, so it's for a variety of things. I mentioned mobbing earlier, and they like to mob predators. They will get on a red-tailed hawk and try to oust it. But they also do that just, when they find a good place to forage where there's lots of pecans. So it could be a variety of things of why they're raucous. It's just in their nature as a corvid to be social and to be very vocal.
All right. Thank you for your call, Cliff. And it's time for our conservation moment. Could you give us a clue about what we're going to talk about this week?
Tonight we're going to talk about mounting nest boxes. There are many fun and useful things you can provide for the birds on your property, whether you live in the city or the countryside. One such item is nest boxes. There are over 80 species of cavity-using birds in North America, including several species of waterfowl, bluebirds, nuthatches, woodpeckers, owls, and more. Only a few of these, namely woodpeckers and nuthatches, are actually capable of chiseling their own cavity with their bill. The rest must rely on an old woodpecker's abandoned cavity or one created by normal wood rot. The species we profiled earlier in this episode, the purple martin, is one of the most popular cavity nesting species across a large swath of the U.S. These nest boxes aren't just for the breeding season. Some actually have a dual purpose. Some cavity-using species will sleep at night in these boxes, especially to keep warm during cold winters. There are plenty of websites that sell bird boxes and other websites that provide blueprints so you can build your own, including the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's website. If you're interested in buying a book with blueprints for a variety of species, including more than just birds, I highly recommend the book called Woodworking for Wildlife by Carol Henderson of Minnesota. There are many other species of insects and mammals that are looking for the same real estate as a bird box, so be sure to mount several boxes and styles in your yard so everything interested might be able to find a home to call their own. Do it for the birds.
All right, Cliff, I want to thank you for joining us again this month.
Great. Thank you, Bill.
You've been listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and we'd like to thank everybody from the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for loaning us him for this evening. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Bird Calls will be posted on our website with the audio here in just about the next 2 hours. The sound files used in tonight's programs were from xenocanto.org and were recorded by Paul Marvin, and this month's bird photos were snapped by James Childress. The next bird call will be on January 8th, so we hope you'll tune in for that. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS and your voice of the community. We are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado, Camden, Magnolia, KLDN, Lufkin, Nacogdoches, and KTYK, Overton, Tyler, Kilgore. Stay tuned, Radio Lab is coming up next.